The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's MadTech Podcast. I'm Rachel Smith, ExchangeWire's CEO, and I have the pleasure of being in the hosting hot seat for the first time in ages for the MadTech Podcast, you lucky listeners. So a very warm welcome to our special guest for this week's episode of the MadTech Podcast, Abtin Fanayan, who is Head of Market Expansion for Asia for Quantcast, based out in Singapore. Hello, Abtin, how are you?
I'm good. How are you guys? Thank you so much for having me today.
Not at all. It's a pleasure. And in the ExchangeWire hot seat joining us on the podcast today, Matt Broughton, our research lead. Hello, Matt. How are you?
Hello, Rachel. I'm good, sir.
Very good. Okay, let's get started with a rundown of this week's news stories that I wanted to chat through with the two of you. Kicking off with some recently released data from Insider Intelligence, telling us that retail media in the US is driving search ad spend at a fairly interesting pace. So it's tipped to grow to 18.7% to the end of this year, which is nearly four times faster than growth in search ad spend in other channels. So what we're talking about here is retail media driving the growth of search advertising spend, obviously within a retail media category and environment. So why is that growth accelerating? Well, advertisers have got fairly significant trust in a retail media environment where evidence shows that advertising placements, which are much closer to the point of sale, do better. And it's also an environment that does fairly well in uncertain economic environments. So during times when perhaps consumers are a little bit wary about what they're spending and where they're spending, they're far more likely to spend more if they're receiving relevant adverts at the point of sale when they're already in a purchasing mindset. So that's why advertisers are shifting some of their dollars there. However, most of this retail media growth spend pertaining to search advertising is going to go, surprise, surprise, to Amazon, who run one of the biggest retail media networks and marketplaces in the US, and they are, in fact, tipped to get about 21% of the overall growth figure for retail media search ad spend, which is 26.9%. So the remaining sort of 4 to 5% is expected to fall into the hands of other retail media giants in the US, such as Walmart and Instacart. But really interesting set of stats there. Obviously, we talk quite a lot in the ad tech industry about the opportunity that retail media presents to advertising technology, but the mechanics of exactly how that's unfolding and how that's unfolding in different global marketplaces is really interesting. So, Abtin, I'm going to come to you in the first instance for your opinion on this. Do you think that this particular growth trajectory, so spend going into search advertising within a retail media network, is an area of opportunity for ad tech? And I'm also really interested to know what you think about retail media in a general sense with an APAC lens.
Yeah, so let me actually take it back to, you covered a lot of stats and you pretty much answered what I'm going to say, but let's bring it back to the stats we're talking about. In a time where we have this kind of economy situation and marketeers are looking for efficiency, retail media makes a lot of sense. One thing we've got to make clear is that search as a consumer behavior is as strong as ever. But where we're making those searches, that's what's changed, right? So you have people like myself, I spend a lot more time searching within retail environments. You have your Gen Z using like TikTok, where I call them discovery or inspirational searches. And the advertisers have to follow that. So I'll give you a story. So I just got back from London. And one of the things I noticed that every house that I went to, every family that I visited, everyone's got an air fryer. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's to do with utility bills or is it like some kind of a trend, but everyone's got an air fryer. So when I got back to Singapore, I got hit by a display ad, one of the air fryer brands. And the first thing I did, I went to the retailer of my choice and searched for air fryer, right? It came up with lots of options, sponsored ads. I looked at a couple of reviews and I bought it, right? Now, if you look back at it, before people used to go to the search engine, the consumer journey was a lot longer. Now, it's a lot shorter. And the reason, if you look at why advertisers are taking retail media, especially sponsored ads, so seriously is that you're so close to a consumer who's about to make a purchase, you know, and that's the key thing for me. And in a time where you have to be super efficient, it makes a lot of sense. And, you know, sponsored ads, I would consider them as first generation of retail media solutions. You know, there's going to be a lot more upper funnel. We're talking about offsites and so on. But at this moment of time, I'm not surprised the numbers you mentioned, 27% of overall search budget now goes to retail media, and Amazon gets a huge chunks of that. It makes a lot of sense, especially in a time, as you mentioned, marketeers have to be a lot more efficient with their marketing dollars.
Yeah, and I think that's a really interesting point that, activity pertaining to search is just as strong as it's ever been, potentially stronger as, more and more of our lives become digitized. And I think you painted quite an interesting picture in terms of where people go to search for products.
Yeah.
So you can just see that there's a multiplicity of behaviors that are unfolding underneath search activity. And I think the next couple of years are going to be really interesting to see how that all sort of solidifies and which of those behaviors become rise to the top in terms of becoming the default way that people discover new products. Matt, what's your particular perspective on this, and especially perhaps from the point of view of how you might search for particular products or categories yourself, what your type of search activity looks like, what with being a millennial? No, you're a zillennial. No, what are you?
I'm a millennial, I think.
You're a millennial.
I think I'm one of those.
You're a young millennial. We've got. Yeah. I mean, come on, Rishi Sunak's a millennial. You're a lot.
Don't cast me in that bucket. I think retail media is certainly one of the biggest opportunities in the sector. And as much as obviously Amazon's growing at such a huge rate, they've already got such a huge slice of the pie. I think it kind of draws people into the perspective that it's an Amazon-only show. And that's just, that as a notion is just absolute nonsense. We did some research at the start of the year that showed that all retailers, two-thirds of all retailers, they're looking to increase their commerce media investments. And it's an opportunity that ad tech as a sector cannot afford to miss, because 80% of those retailers are looking to work with third parties to help them facilitate that. We've all seen the news earlier on this week or early last week with Uber finally reaching profitability, and one of the main reasons for that was its $650 million run rate on its advertising program. Bit of napkin maths for you, but if the ad revenue growth matches that of its merchant growth, it could be looking at ad revenues of close to $1 billion by the close of next year, which is in line with their target. And extrapolating that out, you could be looking at a $4 billion business within 5 years' time, which is just shows the and demonstrates the scale of the opportunity. But it's something I think as an industry we do have to be quite careful about. We can't, disturb the user experience by falling back into some of the old habits that the industry has had in terms of, the retargeting, endless wave of adverts showing you a kettle that you've already bought. It's just something we have to be careful about, but it's an area which I'm so excited about.
I mean, that's another point, right? Which is, what are those marketplaces going to look like from here onwards? Not only do we have to push against the bad habits that the industry is constructed from years of hyper-personalized targeting, but also I'm wondering who's going to take the lead in terms of being able to get enough audience, I suppose, in a retail media environment that's going to be really exciting for brands. And where I'm going with this is, I don't know, Abton, what your point of view is being based in out there in Asia, but as Matt mentioned, Uber's profitability is now really being driven by its advertising business. The ride-hailing, ride-sharing business just was never going to stack up financially. Certainly that has to be the case even for the Southeast Asian ride-hailing apps, which we know have been hugely successful businesses. They are now very firmly in the category of super utility apps, and Uber is obviously trying to head off in that direction in other markets as well. Who's going to be leading here? there? Are we going to, you know, will it be those utility apps that have got the opportunity to offer a full range of services to attract a larger audience, so they're not actually just going to their favourite retailer to search for a product? They're instead going to the platform that makes it easiest for them to do a whole range of tasks, and that's where the retail media advertising opportunity will be. What's your point of view on that?
I think advertisers are going to go to whoever has the scale, right? Especially in a world of like when, you know, at the beginning, right? Like, so things might change. At the moment, you know, the easiest option is to go to like the likes of the Amazon, the Walmarts and so on, right? Because as we're moving away from like, you know, the cookies and so on, everyone's looking for that first party data, right? So there's this first party data, the big retailers. But as like, you know, as what Matt was saying, you know, it's really important to make sure that a lot of these retail environments, they don't get too polluted, you know, so there's not sponsored ads everywhere. So we're just going to go back to how it was with retargeting. And, you know, right now, nearly 85% of all the retail media budget happens on site. Okay. So that's the one thing we got to like remember, where the opportunity is off site. And I'm not talking about offline. I'm talking taking that first party data and, you know, applying it to the open web, applying it to out of home, applying it to CTV. That's where it's going to get really interesting. So, you know, there could be a point that you're watching a football match and, you know, during the break, you see a CTV ad for, you know, for a beer brand, and you could actually get it delivered to your house, you know, just before the break. And using all of your data points, I think that's the true potential of retail media. So going outside of its own environment, so, you know, CTV out of home. But there's still a lot of work to be done. Right now, there's a huge hype, like, you know, this train hype, and everyone's really happy, you know, because it's delivering, it's promising, it's bringing revenue. But very soon, I think advertisers are going to be asking for more transparency. There's going to be asking for more robust third-party measurement. That's what we got to sort out in order for it to grow. And I think it will happen. Right now, the big guys, they can, you know, they kind of go, here's my price, take it or leave it. But as the competition gets more, like, you know, more fierce, you're going to have a lot of more players coming to the market. That's where everyone has to kind of go to, like, you know, the drawing board, and we've got to do this properly. Like, you know, you can't just, you've got to have the right measurement, you know, the right policies in place. I think that's where we're going to see their growth.
Okay, that's super interesting. Loads of potential challenges, you know, from a tech point of view there, and loads of opportunity for innovation, right, to try and solve those challenges. Heaps of things that we could dive into a bit more detail on that, but I'm going to move us on because we'll come back to some of that later on. So second news story was a really interesting thought piece published by Tom Roach, who's VP Brand Strategy at Jellyfish, on the conundrum of attention in marketing and advertising. So we know that waning attention in terms of exposure to advertising and marketing campaigns is a big issue in the marketing and advertising industry. Tom's got some really interesting takes on that, obviously coming from a solid creative background. He points to the premise that we've sort of already mentioned this, that actually part of the attention issue is tied up with legacy behaviours from the early days of ad tech, where we were really focusing on, you know, high volume, direct response, hyper-targeted, hyper-personalised, not great quality advertising. That's obviously had, you know, those ads, on, in addition to being annoying and all leaving us with that sort of, you know, post-traumatic stress image of being chased around the internet by the kettle or the pair of shoes or whatever it was. They were also just really ignorable, you know, as irritating as they were, they're really ignorable ad formats, right? So I think the entire industry accepts that that is no longer a constructive way to undertake marketing and advertising. And there's got to be a better solution to producing quality advertising. And I think the debate is very much firmly in the camp of creativity plays a huge role in that. So Tom, in this thought piece, notes some really interesting research that says that it's more about platform and format that has the impact on the range of potential attention that anyone can pay to an ad in a particular environment or context. You know, it's not just about the quality of the quality of the creativity and the content. But he goes beyond that to say where he thinks creativity plays a key role is in making sure that within that range of attention, which might already be reduced to some extent, what gets you to the top of that range, what gets you most likely to be able to retain any element of memorable attention that's going to have an impact on your ROI as a brand, is really impactful creative output. He talks about the fundamentals that he thinks are essential to creating good quality or to producing good quality creative, which of course covers things such as being really clear about your brand positioning and your communication strategy, making sure that you've got a really fundamentally clear creative message, but also making sure that you are centering on a point of differentiation. There are such a high volume of platforms and environments in which we can be reaching people. You need to be doing something that's a little bit different, no matter how. It doesn't necessarily need to be hugely dramatic, but it just needs to be a point of differentiation. And we need to be evoking emotion, which is the thing that I think we can probably all remember from our childhood. Certainly I can, of days where you just watched what was on telly and you didn't have a choice. And when the ads were engaging, they were things that made you feel something. So he's kind of harking back to some really what he would call fundamental pillars that need to be paid attention to in order for good creative. But his main point here, which I thought was a really interesting argument, is that actually the creative needs to be knock it out the park as you can make it. But if it's not in the right platform or the right format, you're wasting your time. And he then talks about, obviously, the tactics that you need to be using on social media platforms that have become places of entertainment, and then principally whether that creative environment needs to be powered by marketing professionals or powered by creators, and whether that needs to be organic, you know, creator-led content. And his point of view is that it really needs to come from that point of creativity. And I thought that was an interesting juxtaposition, actually, because I'm pretty sure there's plenty of marketing professionals out there that would feel very confident of their ability to create compelling creative output. So, long-winded summary. Matt, I'm going to come to you in the first instance. Is creativity, or the lack thereof, one of the root causes of waning attention in advertising and marketing?
I don't think it's the root cause, but it's definitely a contributing factor. And I think Roach is bang on the money when pointing out that much of the industry has been sucked into that performance vortex that we've discussed earlier. And it's so important to craft content around the specific platform and those first-party audiences, rehashing one single run-of-the-mill campaign across display, out-of-home, TV, all the different channels is just not going to work. I think the focus on attention has been hugely positive for the industry, but also at the same time, I think we can't look at it with almost one hand over our eye, in the sense that frequency is also hugely important. You can have this brilliant, emotive, eye-catching piece of creative that works so perfectly for the platform, but if you run it on every single ad break, people are going to switch off from it and it's no longer going to get that attention. So that also has to be factored into the mix. And also industry standards around attention also need to be looked at. And again, another research survey we ran earlier in the year, two-thirds of UK media buyers suggested that there's currently a lack of industry standards for attention measurement, which means it's clear that we need to look beyond, or at least in addition to, you know, the traditional viewability framework standards, you know, the 50% of creative needs to be in view with, you know, for 2 seconds. I know that, you know, the likes of IAB UK and IAB Europe are looking into that, and definitions will follow, but it's just something that the industry needs to be kept aware of and keep on top of to make sure that we don't have one provider, you know, saying this is attention and another going, you know, this is attention. And finally, to Roach's point in terms of, you know, the content creators and the influencers making content, yes, if they do it in a kind of properly native and organic way that really ties in well with the content. I'm sure we've all seen, whether it's on TikTok, whether it's on YouTube, anywhere where you get that kind of more creator content from, we've all seen, you know, we've been watching this lovely piece of content and then they go into some random juxtaposed advert about a mobile game or something that just completely doesn't tie in with what you're watching. And that can just feel so off. Which again, it just needs to, if it can be tied in to that creator's audience and that creator's content, then yes, it can work so well, but don't try and shoehorn in a random ad where it wouldn't necessarily work.
Yeah.
So true.
Yeah, exactly. I reckon we've all come across those random ads, right? But I also feel like there is a bit of a, on the one hand, there's a little bit of a pushback against influencer-led content for all of the reasons that you just described, Matt, you know, connected to authenticity. But again, I guess that comes back to the environment and the format, you know, the platform and the format. And then on the other hand, that there is this notion that certainly if it's coming from an authentic place, that creator-led content will be more compelling and more impactful. But really interestingly, I know it must have been about a year ago in the lead up to ATS Singapore last year, we were talking about live commerce and shoppable commerce. And mm-hmm. we were chatting with a colleague that does a lot of work in China with brands that are executing on various platforms their live commerce and shoppable commerce campaigns. And they were saying that the content that worked better and produced better ROI was actually product specialists and rather than influencer-led content. So I just find this all really interesting. You know, I'm no expert in any of the fields, so I've got no real prediction as to how it's going to unfold. And maybe a lot of it is a personal preference as well. But I feel as though it's a little bit of a the creativity piece, I can completely understand. Compelling creative is essential. The where it comes from, you know, whether it's creator-led or whether it's sort of marketing professional-led, I feel less convinced by. Acton, what's your point of view?
I mean, as Matt said, it really depends on the environment, right? So you could be spending millions of pounds on a really good video asset, but trying to run it in TikTok makes no sense because you know, in a completely different environment, is a creator environment, it's a community, it's an entertainment platform. So you really got to know your audience and the platform that you're using. And, you know, one of the things that we always see is that, as again, Matt said, you take one asset, you repurpose it for different platforms. Simply in a time where attention is so hard to grab, you got to really think about, you know, who's my audience, what platform I'm running in. And the way I look at it is like the key and the lock analogy. Key is your creative and the lock is like, you know, the potential to unlock that attention. And they go very much hand in hand. So that's super important. You know, one example, I don't know if you guys saw this last year, Tesco ran a TikTok competition to find the next voice after self-checkouts, right? Now, it was amazing. I mean, I'm 37 years old and I must have watched this, like, go through all this like, you know, entries, like people submitting the voice and so on. Now, Tesco, you know, when it comes to TikTok, is not going, hey, please shop at Tesco. Well, what they're doing, they understand the environment, they understand the audience, they're bringing the, like, you know, the fun element of the brand and they're focusing, you know, just instead of the immediate ROI, they're looking at long-term brand building, you know, and that's super key. You should have seen the level of engagement. You know, the lady who won it, people were saying, you know, I can't wait to go to Tesco on my next lunch break and hear your voice. And, you know, that's what you called being creative, understanding the environment and the customers that you're trying to reach. So, you know, that kind of stuff, we need to see more. And, you know, a lot of people are saying that, you know, generative AI might help with some of these. But if we are going to focus on just cost and speed, then we're going to have issue because it's going to be quantity over quality, right? Mm. And already grabbing attention is hard as it is. So if we are just going to be using, you know, generative AI and so on to just get a lot of ads out there in such a short amount of time, we're going to have further problems. But if we get it right, then, you know, it could really work. Personalization could go to the next level. And finally, we could see the next level of, you know, dynamic creative optimization, DCOs, you know, like real like potential is there. But yeah, again, going back to your point, I think it's all about making sure that the messaging and creative is tailored for each platform. And I know it's costly, but if you're serious about brand building, then you got to put the time and effort into it.
100%. I mean, you know, I think also, you know, Roach in his thought piece does make, you know, the differentiation between this sort of long-term brand building and, you know, driving short-term ROI. So you can see how important that that creative piece that isn't necessarily explicitly about a call to action in that moment is for that long-term brand building, that really impactful entertaining moment. But I think the thread that runs through all of this is authenticity. So if people feel like the messaging is too manufactured, too similar to everything else that they've read or everything else that they've experienced, then it's going to garner less attention. And, you know, the TikTok Tesco campaign example that you just gave there, I just think the beauty of that was not just that it was entertaining, but it was also that it had direct relevance to people's lives. It's the idea that people every could day. Walk away from that experience exactly and go, oh, wow, this is amazing. I'm actually going to hear your voice in the supermarket next time I come in. And, you know, it sort of brought, I suppose it brings the elements of that kind of shared entertainment experience to life. It's the reason why we like to watch things together or know that other people are consuming the same stuff as us that's entertaining so that we can talk about it and live this experience together. And that's really interesting.
Again, I'm 37 years old, and I tried to do it a few times to see if I should submit my entry. Then I decided very quickly, no, move on. But you know, that's as you said, it's all about that brand experience and
and that's what's going to resonate, right? Yeah,
emotional. Emotional connection.
And I guess it links to that point of differentiation as well that Roach mentioned in his article. Super interesting stuff. Right, moving us on to third news story, back to the world of retail and specifically retail media networks. News this week in the retail world that Walmart are looking to expand their already pretty impressive retail media network platform called Walmart Connect, which they launched back in 2021, to include in-store radio ad placements and live in-person shopping demonstrations. So what we're talking about here is using some tried and trusted, more traditional channels, something in person, something audio related, but in an in-store environment, connecting it to the retail media network platform that they've already got, which obviously combines activity online and in-app. So Walmart are a juggernaut of a retailer in the US, as I'm sure everybody's really well aware of. But, you know, they have some, I think it's 4,700 stores and across the US and 139 million customers who either visit the store, the website or the app on a weekly basis. So they've got an enormous customer base in which to try to reach with, you know, with various advertisers' products. So you can see how them wanting to expand their retail media network offering to leverage these in-store moments is a really compelling proposition for them and also for the advertiser. I just think that it will be really interesting to see how the technology element of this stacks up. So what does marrying their, you know, highly tech and data infused retail media network platform and Walmart Connect, what does that look like with the actual in-store activity and how sophisticated will that offering become? So question to you in the first instance, Abten, do you think this is going to be a successful strategy for Walmart? Obviously, what they're looking to do here is expand their retail media network, get more advertisers through the door and get that scale that we've already talked about in both of the stories already in the podcast today. So is it going to work for Walmart? And if it does, can you see other retailers trying something similar?
Okay. So the simple fact here is that retail media is very profitable. You know, I was reading in Reuters that in some cases, the margins can go up to 90%, right? So it's a very crucial income for a lot of these players. But one thing that we got to remember is that it has to be relevant to customer environment. You know, we should not let monetization overrule experience, right? You know, that's super key. And I feel like, you know, a lot of these retailers, they have so much data, they have so much ideas. There's so much sponsored ads going on. They go, okay, what's next? What's next? Let's let you know. So it's all about test and learn. but you know, someone like Walmart, I got a lot of time for this brand. A brand at this size doing so much experiments and, you know, doing test and learn. So I'm pretty sure that if they feel like that is an impacting user, they will go back to the drawing board, because you know, the physical assets, the stores are so important for them. So they I think they're going to be very cautious about it. Now, the other side you can look at it is that it might enhance experience. Like, you know, so for example, if you've seen a Hoover on the retailer brand, and then you get a message, hey, there's a store next, like, you know, 5 minutes away from you, why don't you come in for an in-store demo and have a look for yourself, and there's an offer and so on. You know, to me, that's powerful, right? Mm. But again, you have to make sure it's not too creepy. So you have to make sure there's a balance between that. But again, like, you know, I was in Japan about 3 months ago, and I went to a retailer in Tokyo. I'm not going to name them. It's one of those that, like, you know, you have to go if you're visiting, like, you know, Tokyo. And I'm a very sociable person. I love crowd. I love people. But within 3 minutes, I had to get out because there were so many, you know, in store, like in screens and demos. I was just like, whoa. Like, you know, I can't even go to the next aisle. Yeah. So that's like, you know, the extreme case of it. Yeah. But if you get it right, I think it could be really impactful, especially, I know obviously COVID seems so long ago. People are actually happy to be back in shops again, you know, that physical experience going around and looking for things. So if you do it right, you could influence the customer. But again, I can't emphasize enough, like in digital marketing, regardless if it's retail, media and so on, monetization should never overrule user experience, because you could have the most amazing solution, the most amazing product. If you annoy customers, it's all gone. Yeah. So that's a really key thing for me. But yeah, Walmart, yeah, I you know, as I said, they will test it. And if it doesn't work, they pull it back very quickly. Again, I love the brand.
And they've got, I mean, the thing is they've got so much, you know, physical real estate to play with there, right? So they can be testing it in so many different ways.
Exactly.
And I'm guessing it's something that might potentially, depending on the type of activations we're talking about, maybe it works better in certain parts of the US than it does in others. I'm thinking about the convenience element. You know, if I'm somewhere, if I live somewhere where I have a car and it's really easy to drive to the nearest Walmart stall, I'm likely to be tempted with in-store activity. If I'm in the middle of New York City and, you know, even though there's loads of Walmart stalls, smaller Walmart stalls probably. If it's not convenient and if it's not, you know, if it's not super interesting, I'm not going to bother, right? So, but they've got lots of opportunity to test that scenario. Matt, what do you think, further to Abson's point, you know, is the industry going to be able to, will Walmart be able to avoid, you know, the temptation to over-advertise in this type of environment? Will they get it right in their quest to grow their retail media network? You know, will they be able to balance out the competing priorities appropriately?
They're certainly making the right noises about it. It was very heartening to hear Maywood demonstrating caution about how they're going to expand the network, and to Abton's point, saying that, you know, the users will come first, our shoppers will come first, we're never going to disturb the experience. And I think Walmart's, it's definitely singing the industry's tune. Retail media and CTV, two of the most talked about mediums or channels in the sector, and partnering with NBC Universal, that's going to be a really interesting tie-up to see how that plays out. And I'd love to see the numbers from that if they do get released. Obviously, you had the example earlier about buying the beer during halftime and that coming, so that may come into play. But we've also seen, you know, we've seen a lot of the big tech platforms looking around sports streaming. And I think if, you know, if this were to take off, wouldn't be surprised to see Amazon loosening the purse strings even more to get even more live sports. In terms of some of Walmart's plans, I think the in-store audio tie-up I'm a huge fan of that. I think that can work well for buyers to be able to, you know, to buy placements within that. But the sampling carts, I'm not 100% sure about. It may work for, you know, the more tech or household goods, but say if I'm, you know, I'm in the shop, I'm going to buy a lovely bit of cheese and I get this lovely sample of a bit of cheese. If I don't buy the block of cheese there and then, I don't think I'm going to be set on scanning a QR code, or if it's on a screen at the checkout, I'm going to go, I've got my full trolley, but I'm going to go back for this cheese.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point, because You know, I heard some retailers are looking at like putting screens at the checkout. Surely that's too late. Yeah. You know, by the time you had a checkout, you're not going to go back for a block of cheese. So that's a really valid point. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and in terms of that QR code, obviously I can see why they're doing that, obviously to get that data in and that, you know, that extra data point in for the Connect platform. But also, if I'm going to buy cheese, I probably know what I'm going to do with it. I'm either going to down it in one or drown an otherwise perfectly healthy plate of pasta. I'm not necessarily going to be scanning that QR code. So yeah, I think it can work for tech goods, and I like that Hoover example earlier. I think that can, obviously other vacuum brands are available, I think, you know, that could play well. But yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see how that actually pans out, because I think for the more sort of grocery goods, it may not be. But it's interesting that they're at least trying these different
strategies. And that's, yeah, so you raised some really interesting points there. I sort of mentioned in the intro, it'll be interesting to see how they sort of make the tech side stack up with the in-store experiences. As you mentioned there, they plan to use QR codes to try to draw a link between items that you might see in store and then that you then might want to go on and purchase. But like you rightly say, that's got to be timed appropriately in order for people to really be taking advantage of it. And then you also mentioned the partnership with NBC Universal, which is them, you know, Walmart making their retail media network ads available on streamed sporting activity. That seems like a huge area of opportunity. But again, here we are discussing a sort of a US example where it feels like those decisions are almost no brainers because they'll be marketing to such a massive audience. I'm not saying that you couldn't strike a similar partnership in other global marketplaces, for example, here in the UK, but I'm imagining you'd have to jump through a few more hoops to make it possible. You've then got to start thinking about how worthwhile it is and what the size of audience that you're going to be, marketing towards is likely to be, which just sort of, you know, potentially reduces the degree to which you're prepared to be experimental. But so it's not surprising that we're seeing a lot of this being led from the US, where we're looking at massive retailers in a huge homogenous marketplace. There's very few other countries quite like it in that sense. I think what's super interesting about this, though, is thinking about how it could enhance that in-store shopping experience. Abton, you mentioned it. People are enjoying, or have the potential anyway, to enjoy that in-store shopping experience a bit more now than they did, you know, sort of a few years ago. If we think about life pre-pandemic, nobody ever really thought about whether they would have, whether shopping in real life would be something that they wouldn't be able to do. Everyone always just assumed it was going to be there if they needed it, if they wanted it. And now we sort of see it through a slightly different lens, I think, post-pandemic, which is that it's an opportunity. And this is, in my opinion, how retailers should be seeing it. It's an opportunity for something that could be far more entertaining and sociable than people ever thought shopping could be before. Because we've all had those shopping experiences, even similar to the one you just mentioned there in Tokyo, where you're excited about it, but you get there's too many people, it's annoying. You can't really see what you're doing. This is irritating, inconvenient, blah, blah. But there's plenty of opportunity to create shopping experiences, even in crowded environments that are not like that. And I think it'd be really interesting to see them try to enhance that in-store experience, because they've otherwise got to find a justification for maintaining their 4,700 bricks and mortar stores across the US, since we know the trend is going in the opposite direction in general in terms of holding a really big footprint for bricks and mortar. So I think that could be interesting. You know, where this takes us in terms of tech innovation maybe is another interesting layer as well, as the two of you have just discussed. What kind of mechanisms will be used to make the most of this and make sure that it's not being obtrusive? Lots of things for us to consider. I'm going to move us on to the second part of this week's podcast to focus a little bit more on you, Abton. Could you tell us a little bit more about your role at Quantcast over there in Singapore, since it sounds like a pretty interesting gig? And and tell us a little bit more about, you know, what head of market expansion means.
Yeah, sure. So just again, my name is Abton Finayan. I've been at Quantcast for 8 years, moved to Singapore about 5 years ago. I was one of those people that only came for 2 years and the rest is history. So I head up market expansion, and essentially what that means is that is my team and I are responsible for opening new markets across Asia. So, you know, like for example, like Hong Kong, we go to those markets, we build partnership with agency brands, building case studies, educate the market. And then once we have, obviously enough revenue, enough case studies and enough partnerships, then we build a local team and I'll move on to the next market. So it's a pretty exciting role. And we've seen an incredible amount of growth in places like Philippines, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Korea. So yeah, that's what I do. And I travel a lot.
Yeah, it sounds like it. That is a great role for somebody that enjoys traveling. So I hope you do.
Yeah, I love traveling. My wife doesn't.
Good. Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a problem. So that's interesting. So markets where you're seeing rapid growth, what were they again? You said Philippines, Korea. Was there anywhere else in Southeast Asia in particular that's standing out? I'm asking because, you know, often when we think about the context of, 2023 has been a year of a lot of global economic uncertainty, we often look to Asia for a bit more certainty because we know that there's some markets within, especially Southeast Asia, that are much more growth-oriented. So, what are you seeing?
So for us, Hong Kong is still very important. There's still a lot of, financial headquarters in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
So that's a bit more mature, but it's still very important. But where we're seeing, the huge growth is across markets such as Philippines, Indonesia, and it's purely down to the size of the population. And, it's really, really fascinating markets, and they're very willing to try new things. All of the retail marketing that we're talking about and so on, it doesn't just relate to US and UK. We've seen a huge growth here as well. Those markets Philippines is a huge focus for us. Like my team and I, travel to those markets at least once a month. It's a big opportunity there.
Okay, that's fascinating. We're hoping to be able to, focus a little bit more on some activity that's underway in the Philippines at ATS Singapore this year, get a little bit of market specialism involved in some of the panel discussion sessions, because it's fascinating to hear how things are unfolding in those really densely populated markets like Indonesia and Philippines. So I hope we can dedicate some content to that. So just as a sort of a closer as well, I wanted to just get your views on one of the other news stories of the week that we didn't have time to discuss in full, but all three of us thought it was really interesting, which is around marketers' perceptions of how important it is to acquaint themselves with AI in order to perform their roles. And I suppose what I wanted to hear from you, Abton, is a bit of perspective on how much you think AI is impacting marketing and advertising at the moment and where you think that's going to go, bearing in mind that this particular news article showed some results of a survey that said nearly 70% of marketers felt like it was going to be really critical to their role in the coming few years. What are you seeing, especially in Asia, which can often be a very technology-led market?
Yeah. So, as we know, AI is nothing new, right, even in the world of marketing. So I've been at Quantcast for 8 years, and, we've been using AI and machine learning from day one, so since 2006. And when I first started with Quantcast, trying to sell Quantcast solutions, it was actually really hard because, you talk about machine learning, using algorithms to create lookalike models and so on, and it was too futuristic. People couldn't really understand it. They see it as like a black box. And, in a lot of cases, we struggled to get on plans and so on, but it took a lot of time to educate in the market. And what we see now, thanks to things like ChatGPT, pretty much, everyone has a decent understanding. People don't exactly understand how it works, but they see the use of it, right? And when we brought out our self-serve platform, agencies, brands start using it and seeing how much time they're saving and how much performance they're driving, suddenly it wasn't a black box. They could see the value of AI. And, the reason we're seeing those level of education and people, using more AI-based products is it's accessible, right, to the masses. It's no longer this, futuristic, it's happening now. Yeah. And, while I'm really excited about the whole AI side is doing more A-B testing. I think like in the world of media, we don't do enough A-B testing because it takes a lot of time, resources, A-B testing, producing content, insights, predicting trends. But I can't, you know, stress enough that we shouldn't just focus on cost and the speed, because if we are focusing on cost and speed, it's only going to be about like quantity, not quality. And that's where like, you know, it could go wrong, right? Mm. And for me, in terms of in the world of marketing, it's not really about replacing your strategies, but it's about enhancing them, right? So if you have tools that can give you more time so you could focus on a strategy implementation and so on, that's really important. And in a way, I also think it's like it's almost an obligation for anyone, regardless of what the industry you're in, to understand the basics of AI, right? So you don't exactly need to understand, you know, how it works. So it's good to understand it, but understanding how you could apply it to your everyday life, your work and so on, so to be more productive at work. But also, you know, you have to be able to, when a partner comes to you, you have to be able to vet them to see, like, you know, is this like, you know, an impactful solution, or is just a bit of a smoke and mirrors? Because that's, we're going to see a lot of those, right? You know, with every new technology, there's going to be so many new players coming into the market, and they might just like, you know, classify automation as AI. So I think it's really essential for the marketing world, for any industry, to have the basic of understanding, so you'd be able to, you know, very quickly realize, you know, is this solution worth investing on? Because you know, you could be investing a lot of money, time and resources, and realize, oh, it's actually not what we need. And again, there's a lot of hype, like, you know, and generative AI and so on. So you have to test. There's no question about that. But just don't make all these quick decisions and just, like, you know, do it just because everyone else is doing it. It has to make sense for your organization. You need to make sure your people are skilled enough to understand the value of it. So that's really important as well.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it sounds like a sort of a cautionary tale for every tech decision that's taken in ad tech, basically. I think probably there's been a lot of people, especially early ad tech days, that didn't feel they necessarily had the tech capabilities to fully assess some of the tools and solutions that they felt they needed. And there was definitely a bit of a, you know, wave of panic throughout the years of things that various businesses felt they needed to have, especially, you know, if we go back to the days of brands assessing whether they ought to in-house solutions or not. You know, there was this whole sense of what exactly do we need this solution for? Could we be doing it better? You know, could we be saving money, and could we be performing all of this more efficiently if we had it in-house? Can we build it ourselves? You know, that whole, and I'm not saying, that's obviously a very complex picture. I'm hugely simplifying it. I'm not saying that some brands haven't continued down that in-housing path and gotten some really good benefits from it, but I think we've come to a much more sophisticated moment in time for advertising and marketing technology, where the tech tools and solutions that most businesses want to take on obviously need to be properly assessed, but are much more viewed through the lens of sustainability. Is this something that we need for fundamental reasons? How is it going to support our business from a sustainable point of view? I mean, you know, holistically. I'm not talking specifically about environmental sustainability there. I'm talking about creating sustainable business models and using tech tools to support that. So I can kind of see how, you know, we need to apply that lens when thinking about AI as well. I just wonder where you think the sort of next steps will be for advertisers and marketers, because I can see that AI tools will have a direct application to making things more efficient and, you know, making things easier. But those sort of test cases or use cases speak to cost and efficiency, and as you said before, that can't be the only drivers. That can't be the only reason that you focus on artificial intelligence and various AI-driven tech tools that can help and assist you. So, what do you think will be the, you know, that feels like the entry level? Is this going to make my job easier? Is this going to make things smoother? What do you think the next level of you know, knowledge and understanding is that marketers should have in order to really bake AI into their businesses with some sense of value?
I think it's quite simple. You know, advertisers should be demanding agencies and vendors to spend more time with their staff, like, you know, talk about, like, you know, the basics of AI, clearly explaining, like, you know, if a vendor is trying to make things sound complicated and sophisticated, like, you know, that's a sign, like, you know, using, like, you know, signals and this, like, you know, is you have to be very, you have to be able to clearly explain the value that is going to drive for the advertiser, right? You know, yeah, that's super important. But there are the opportunity is huge. You know, there's, like, you know, Google is, like, now doing online courses and around generative AI and so on. So it's not like you actually have to, you know, spend much money or time. The sources are available, and you should be asking your agency, you should be asking your vendors to help you upskill, because that's really important. You know, you were talking about, like, you know, in housing and so on, the another case we used to have back in the days was data management platform, DMPs. Like, you know, yeah, people paid, like, you know, $100,000 for a DMP, and they go, oh, I actually don't have enough data to onboard, or I don't have the right data, right? But, you know, when I talk about a hype, it's not a hype, because it's going to be, like, you know, it's going to be part of our life. It's the things are changing, right? We're going to look back at 2023 and go, wow, and in a 50 years time, that was the beginning of the masses to understand the AI. What I'm saying is that you should be test and learn. You know, don't just do it because everyone else is doing it, right? Yeah. And we're going to have regulations. We're going to have policies. You know, right now, there's a lot of focus on, like, you know, producing content and so on. But you know, every good technology in the wrong hands, it also can be bad. There's, like, you know, there's already talking about you could use in generative AI to create fake site images, text, so you could be basically serving impressions on, you know, fraudulent sites. But we have to go through all of this pain to get to the perfect, not the perfect moment, but we have to do that. And it's good it's happening right now, because that's what brings in policies, regulations, and also education, right? So, so education for me is very key here.
That makes perfect sense to me. We will have to wrap it up there. There's so much, as usual, that we could continue talking about, but we've run out of time. Adson, thank you very much for joining us on the podcast today and making yourself available all the way from sunny Singapore. And we look forward to seeing you at ATS.
Great. Thank you so much, guys. Have a good day. Take care.
And Matt, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Thank you, Rachel. Lovely to join you both. And I realise I made a grave error by talking about cheese so much so close to lunchtime. So I'm going to go off and make myself a nice snack.
Fantastic. And thanks, everyone, for listening. That was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.